Hey Decoders, and welcome back to Science Decoded, where we break down recent, contemporary scientific articles for everybody to understand. Science for science's sake. Well, that's what I say anyways. It's me, your host, Justin Dingman, and this month I'm actually in Ohio, enjoying the nice sunny weather, the big storm clouds, and everything else that summer has to offer here out in the Great Midwest. Back in the Rocky Mountains, it's pretty smoky right now, and even Denver had the worst air quality in the United States, and I think in the world yesterday. Recently, on SciWorthy.com, we have a couple new articles published, two of which have been previously published here on this podcast. So you can hear what some of our YSPs, so some of our young scientists, are writing about. The articles are titled, How Scientists Saw the Coronavirus in Living Lung Tissue, and Has Cannabis Legalization Changed Kids' Drug Use? Beyond that, we also have two new articles posted titled Building Blocks of Life May Have Formed from Non-Living Matter and How Using Radio Signals from Exoplanets May Help Us Detect Magnetic Fields. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Anna Maria Barea about how she used her expertise in data science and communication to help some astronomers look at stars in new ways. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about our tips and tricks segment and how to read graphs and understand data from published science papers. The data section of a publication is always the most scrutinized and criticized aspect of any paper. Each journal makes scientists follow special requirements on how to format and display the data the scientists are using to draw their conclusions. Take some time to make yourself familiar with the graphs and figures and understand what they're trying to represent. This is one of the easiest ways to educate yourself on a science paper, and you get to use the same data the scientists did in order to form your own conclusions. This is a lot easier said than done, however. But I'm here to declassify some helpful hints so that you can get more out of each paper you read. First, I recommend trying to redraw the figure in a simple format. Use shorthand to represent large and intimidating vocabulary or conditions that you might not be certain about. Use positive or negative to represent trends, and write question marks next to words or phrases that don't make sense. This way you can refer back to them and look them up later. Next, take care to read labels and titles of the figures, as they can help guide you towards what two variables are actually being compared. And make sure to make a note of that on your drawings as well. Many science articles also include tiny summaries of the figures right below it. Make sure to read those. And highlight and look up any terms that don't make sense. I guarantee Wikipedia has the answer. Check the scale of the figures. A lot of times, these figures and graphs have special scales, or the numbers are much more complex than they appear. For example, if a scientist decided to graph a line and they used numbers to represent an order of magnitude rather than just one unit, then a number two spaces from another number actually shows a difference of 100 units, not just 2 units. This is because in an order of magnitude measurement, scientists are actually counting the number of zeros that go before or after a number. This allows us to compare very big and very small numbers in science, which we have to do constantly. Lastly, begin writing down your observations of the data. Which bars are bigger than the others? Which bars are smallest? Does a line increase or decrease? Once you begin thinking critically about the data in front of you, it doesn't take long until the papers start making a little bit more sense. As I said earlier, today we're going to be talking about communication. Communication is an interesting subject. There are many ways for living things to communicate. Us humans use language, context, emotion, body language, and even our own pheromones. The cells within our body communicate with each other too. No, they don't do this by whispering to each other, otherwise you'd be able to hear all 1 trillion cells talking at the same time. They do this over short and long distances, however. They can send special chemicals and messengers to other cells, telling them it's time to work, or slow down, or even time to die. Cells can release ions, applying currents so nearby cells can talk to each other. They can even apply mechanical pressures onto the cells around them, which helped start the communication process. Scientists still aren't quite sure when these more nuanced aspects of communication began to develop, especially on the cellular level. But we see them in many facets of everyday life. Plants, animals, even in the symbiotic cycles we see between the Earth and living things. And communication is what helps support our ecosystem and helps nature thrive despite its need for a delicate balance. Communication is how this balance is maintained. However, communication is a quite complex phenomenon, and this makes it very hard to study. Imagine a car's engine. You can take it apart piece by piece. The radiator, the water pump, the transmission, the pistons, the heads, the rings, everything. And you can reassemble it. Many, hopefully, get it to work again. But now imagine a human. If you broke us down cell by cell, used a special microscope or a special tool that helped you deconstruct us piece by piece, and then tried to reassemble the cells back together into a human being, well, probably wouldn't have much of a human anymore. Communication is kind of like a human being. When you break it down to its individual part, it becomes hard to predict and hard to study. This causes it to be a complex study. Those who study the science of communication work towards observing and identifying fundamental patterns in communication so that we can begin to classify, understand, and predict communication patterns. In today's paper, The Language of the Stars, we'll be discussing whether or not the same science that goes into studying communication can actually help us understand something new about the stars. Stay tuned as we talk with Dr. Anna Maria Barea about this study and her results about luminosity and classifying stars. Hey, decoders, and welcome back. Today, we're going to be joined by Dr. Anna Maria Barea. She is a data scientist, professor, and researcher at George Mason University. Anna Maria, thanks for joining us. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background, your job, and what you do at George Mason?
Thank you, Justin. It's nice to be here. I'm an associate professor of data sciences at George Mason University. And besides teaching data sciences, I also do research in communication as a complex system and communication in complex systems in general. And I'm also affiliated with Blue Marble Space Institute of Science and with NASA Frontier Development Lab and with the SETI Institute. So under this broad umbrella, I am basically doing data sciences for problems in astrobiology and in space sciences.
Now, when most people hear like, oh, I work in communication, but I also do data sciences, I don't think the relationship is quite obvious to the listeners. Mm-hmm. How did you take your studies of communication and learn how to apply them to data processing?
Data sciences are a broad umbrella of methods that can be applied to basically any fields and any kind of phenomena. Communication, on another hand, is a specific phenomenon. And when I'm talking about communication, I'm not necessarily talking about communication in marketing or in psychology as we tend to understand it, but more broadly, I'm talking about communication more in the sense of information exchange and how communication has developed in living systems all the way from cells all the way to societies. So data sciences are an umbrella of methods that we can apply to different aspects of communication in living systems. So that's where the connection between the two comes in. Additionally, in data sciences, we have this subfield called natural language processing, which is more related to artificial intelligence. And natural language processing aims to understand communication between humans, but also how can we apply what we understand in languages between humans, how we can apply that into technology and perhaps into developing better and more robust algorithms for artificial intelligence. So overall, when we are talking about communication, we are looking at how does this interaction of information exchange has evolved from cells all the way to humans, and how can we apply this to new technologies in artificial intelligence?
Mm. One large stride that your research and that NASA Frontiers Lab is making was expressed in your communication, The Language of the Stars, where you talk a little bit about using what we just talked about, the natural language processing, to process and kind of look at star data taken from telescopes in a new way. What is natural language processing and what do we learn from it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. In general, natural language processing is a body of methods and algorithms that uses text as data or audio files from speech as data. And processes these type of data sets to either find patterns in, let's say, human interactions, in human speech, in human languages, or even to create new text, to create new vocabularies, to create new taxonomies. And when we are talking about natural language processing, you can easily think about Siri or Alexa, which are basically products of some of the most sophisticated NLP algorithms that we have so far. Now, of course, the question is, what does that have to do with the stars, right? One of the projects that we had last summer at NASA Frontier Development Lab was to look into star luminosity data sets for patterns that would either identify star spots or would identify exoplanets. The data came from Kepler, and one idea that I had was, okay, if we want to understand or categorize or understand better the luminosity of these stars, then why not use some of the methods that are specific to NLPs, to natural language processing? Why would we do that? NLP is pretty good at identifying patterns in kind of messy data sets, as we have in, when we are talking about human speech and human languages and text in general. The data is not that clean or robust, the same as its numeric data, right? But NLP is pretty good at identifying patterns in this kind of data sets and in categorizing them, in creating vocabularies and creating taxonomies. So if we want to do the same with the stars, to create, to categorize them and to look at the luminosity of the stars in order to understand better the makeup of these stars, then let's see if we can find something interesting by using natural language processing. Again, when we are talking about the stars from the Kepler dataset, we are talking about the luminosity of these stars. And the luminosity of these stars is has been recorded by the instrument, by Kepler. And the way it's been recorded is basically time series, right? So we are dealing with repeated time series in the way the luminosity of these stars has been measured in time. Now, if we are extracting the time series from here and we want to apply the natural language processing here, we are basically looking at categorizing different bits and pieces of the time series of the stars using NLP. And the better analogy for this would probably be looking into the DNA of the stars. Because the same as when we are talking about communication in living systems, we are looking into, if we are thinking about how cells communicate with each other, we are looking into DNA and how DNA is being exchanged. And DNA are basically long rows of letters, right? They are, we can think of these data sets as, and they have been used for some of the NLP methods as well. So if we want to recreate or to understand the DNA of the stars, let's see how we can use natural language processing.
You mentioned that you're looking at the time series data of these stars. What exactly does that look like, or what exactly does that mean?
The data is, it has been recorded by Kepler. It shows in time the measurement of the luminosity of that specific star. So any star, when you are recording its luminosity, it doesn't have the same value, right? The luminosity changes. Now, the question is, why does it change? Is it because it's an internal process in the star? Is it because there is an exoplanet that passes in front of the star? Or is it because there are star spots on the star? So the way these data sets look like, it's actually not very different from the data sets from financial industry and financial markets. So it looks like these really, you know, really jittery, really kind of like in the, if you look at it with the bird's eye view, it looks very incomprehensible type of, you know, of line that goes up and down, some point looks kind of random or chaotic, but it's not. So the idea here is, how can we identify inside this time series those specific bits and pieces and patterns that we can use them as the granularity to recombine them to understand the luminosity in other stars, and perhaps even in our sun.
No, that's awesome. And I think that makes a lot of sense too, especially as we grow our observation and grow our observing window of space. We need to know how to categorize stars and light emitting objects in our galaxies and in our universe more precisely so that we can learn more information from them. So you mentioned using 6 different natural language processing approaches. Can you explain a little bit more about those methods and what information you got out of doing each one?
Yes. So ideally, in categorizing these stars, we would have an algorithm that would discover even the inside algorithm for categorizing them. I don't know if this makes sense. So, but ideally here, we would try not to impose our own understanding of the language into the star, but rather to have an algorithm that would discover the language of this star.
How do you do that? How do you prevent yourself from imposing your own understanding into what you're trying to research?
That is the very hard question that we have not been able to answer yet. Yes. But until we get there, we tried some algorithms that we know they work when we partition time series in other fields, like in finance, or when we took some work from statistics or from understanding time series in general, and how can we partition these time series in bits and pieces that after we do that, we can actually use to analyze them. So for example, a couple of methods that we used were with respect to binning of the data and looking at the peaks and troughs in the data. If we are looking at the data points that are above zero versus the data points that are below zero, how can we partition those? Or if we are looking at data points that are between 0 and 10 or 10 and 20 and so on. And then we also looked at clustering, and clustering methods are more specific to machine learning. And how can we use clustering methods also to partition these time series in bits and pieces that we can recreate the DNA after this. So we used several methods that we thought from our experience that would be more sensible to use here. But again, the big question right now is, can we develop an algorithm that would basically find the language inside the star without us imposing the way we are partitioning the time series?
Oh, yeah. And one big thing that I noticed reading the little communication was that you guys had very eloquently separated the difference between binning and also like labeled data points as well. Because I know in data science, a lot of times it's very easy to throw everything into these certain bins that are labeled a certain way, but you guys were really meticulous in how you wanted to divide up the data to make sure that you guys were getting a large enough or a small enough piece.
Yes, that's right. And we use some principles from information theory as well, such as principles of entropy or some principles from complexity science to have a better or more robust method that we can apply into partitioning this time series. Because the trick here, or the most difficult point, is how do you transform those numbers into letters, right? How do you move from numeric data sets into text data sets? How do we create that text that we consider to be the book of the star, right? How can we transform a star into a book? And that can be done pretty randomly, right? But of course, the way we are doing it is going to have an impact into how the NLP algorithm is going to analyze the data and is going to create the vocabularies and the DNAs from these data sets.
Now, when doing a natural language process analysis, is there a minimum amount of data or a minimum amount of information you need to make any conclusions?
No, but again, the more information, the better. So the bigger the data sets, the better it is for fine-tuning our algorithms and our processes. We originally started with about 690 stars, but overall in the Kepler data set, there are more than 150,000. Now, when we are analyzing text, actually textual data is not that big. So let's say if you take text from Shakespeare, or if you take the whole Wikipedia, actually you can download the whole Wikipedia on your computer and analyze it using natural language processing techniques. Textual data is not that big in general. It's image data that it's much bigger and much more difficult to deal with computationally speaking, or it's more computationally expensive. So this is actually another really good point towards why it would be nice and useful to create these books of the stars, because the data sets that we are creating are much more manageable.
No, and that's super helpful. How do you think scientists might be using some of these results and these experiments in the future? And what are some of the results and trends that you've been seeing so far?
We hope that besides trying to catalog these stars, we would be able to translate this into any problem that deals with time series. So let's say that you move from the stars to financial data, which is also time series. Would it be useful and helpful to categorize or to find patterns in those data sets by using natural language processing? And some other ways that I can easily imagine being applied here are with respect to molecular biology. So going right into the DNA and RNA data sets if we are looking into viruses. So I know that one of the big questions right now, for instance, when it comes to virology, and if we are thinking about the whole COVID situation and the whole COVID pandemic, is how do viruses communicate with each other and how do they exchange these RNA molecules? And if there are so many data sets, and in molecular biology usually these data sets are really big, then can we use NLP in the same way as we used them for the stars in order to find patterns and categorize these molecules? So I can see a wide range of applications here, anywhere where looking for patterns inside very noisy or difficult to manage time series. You can apply them to a wide range of fields.
And one huge thing I know about molecular biology, or I guess two huge points. First and foremost, in biophysical chemistry or molecular biology and studying how chemicals move, you know, because they have inherent movement where they're always shifting and changing and going between conformations. We get a lot of time series data out of that as well, because you have to observe these molecules over time to see as they flip back and forth between these conformations. And so I could definitely see that as another potential application for natural language processing. And another really big one too is sequencing. You know, we're looking for these high throughput sequencing methods where we can put in a ton of DNA or a ton of different types of DNA, and then we get these text files out, or they give us the four base reads A, T, G, and C in the randomized order that's mm-hmm. in the DNA. And it would be really useful for natural language processing if we're able to pull out genes or identify which parts of the genes are active or inactive, and what's going on in the cell at that moment is super helpful.
Right, and especially if we are looking at, again, how cells communicate with each other, you can identify where cells miscommunicate with each other. And when cells miscommunicate with each other, it's actually where you have the root of diseases like cancer.
Absolutely. Now, outside of being a great data scientist and someone who gets to study natural language processing, you're also an expert in communication and have two books published on that. Can you tell us a little bit more about those books and some of the things you learned about writing those?
I've been passionate about the idea of information exchange in complex systems for a while now, since I was a graduate student, actually. I've been intrigued by the way information behaves that is very different from any other material, right, that behaves. So when we have two entities, whether it's two humans, two animals, two cells that are interacting with each other, usually when we are exchanging some chemicals, or we are exchanging goods, or we are exchanging something, it's you give up something, right, and then it doesn't belong to you anymore. So you give it to the other. other entity, to the other person. When it comes to information, it's quite different, right? Because you can give all the information that you have without giving up on it, right? Because you still retain that information. So information has a very intriguing property where when you give information, you still retain it. And also when you give negative information, you might induce positive information as well, right? So think of this example, when I tell you don't think about pink elephants, what are you going to think about? It's the pink elephants. So I've been really intrigued by the way information behaves in complex systems and how this whole information exchange has evolved basically from cells to humans, and how can we translate this into our next technologies. Because if we are thinking about how different species of animals, how they are communicating with each other, it's very species specific, right? So species understand within their group, within their species, their own language. And it's very, very difficult to transcend these interspecies barriers. We kind of understand dogs, right? And we kind of interact with dogs, although not entirely fully. Or maybe we have interactions and we understand dolphins or the big apes. But still, it's very difficult for us to actually transcend these barriers between interspecies. On another hand, communication is such a fundamental process and information is so fundamental that it has spanned our evolution of life, right from the origins of life until we are today, right? And we moved from the type of communication that is more, say, electrical or electromagnetic or chemical, we moved into abstract communication that came once human languages have emerged. So how come something that is so fundamental is also so different and context specific? So I've been really intrigued by these kind of questions. And basically, can we discover some fundamental laws or some universal laws of communication in living systems that we can afterwards apply to designing better technologies, to understanding the other species on our planet much better, or even to understanding whether there is life on other planets?
Absolutely. And as you said, too, we've already seen two very applicable benefits from natural language processing and the study of communication, both through Siri and Alexa and some of the other natural language processing elements and advanced algorithms that we see being used, whether it's in the financial industry or even social media or anything for personal gain and in personal technology as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
What are some other things you're currently studying about communication or that you're looking into right now as we speak?
I am really looking into these fundamental patterns in communication. Again, how did communication co-evolve with the medium? How did we move from chemical to olfactory to auditory and then to more abstract communication? What is the role of body language in different animal species that has been also translated into body language and then again into more abstract languages for us, for humans? So I'm trying to look more into the process itself and the evolution of the process itself of the communication with life. I'm trying to remove a little bit the idea of communication from very specific species or environments and trying to get a bigger lens, right, and a bigger view into the evolution of the whole process and the co-evolution with various complex systems.
You also mentioned, with your mention of body language, you did talk about previously how maybe the most difficult step of the natural language processing in the stars was taking this time series data or this binary data and turning it into textual data. How do you do something like that with body language that's so contextually unique, and even more so, people are born every day without the ability to identify body language, as we see diagnosis with autism spectrum disorder go up and up and up. How is that something that you're able to account for in your algorithms?
That's a really good question. So far, we are looking only at different mechanisms, again, like more fundamental mechanisms of cooperation and competition, right? or how the interactions between the different entities within a species, whether it's humans or other species, whether those are, again, cooperative, they are beneficial for both entities, or they are competitive, or even for predator predation, or if they are for mating, for instance, right? So again, I'm trying to find that sweet balance between getting lost into the details, because those will never end, right? And looking at the bigger patterns that can identify across different mediums of communication and different ways through which different species are communicating. So again, body language per se is interesting from the biological or psychological points of view, but from the communication perspective is more about whether it's cooperation and competition and how does this relate in general with social behavior and sociality in different species. And we can follow this line of thought, again, across species and try to transcend those interspecies boundaries.
You know, I'm really excited about the idea of investigation into behavioral patterns and even more so into this body language aspect, because it can be so hard for even humans to pick up on and diagnose it and categorize. And I think that putting an algorithm to it could really be beneficial for us to understand more about how we even come across to each other, or how animals are interacting with us and animals are interacting with other animals. And I think that's just, it's important to know for our context and where we are in the world.
Yes, I agree. And also this relates to the idea of multiple ways of communication, right? Because we are not communicating in just one way. I mean, you and me right now, we are basically using auditory communication. We can only hear each other. But in general, when we are communicating with our peers, it's a wealth of communication that comes to us. It comes from our visuals. It comes from our maybe olfactory system. It comes from understanding the different intonations or patterns in the voice. And so it's, in general, the more complex an organism is, then the more complex is communication. And again, it's not just one type, right, of communication. It's a combination of different types of communication. So that's another thing that it's quite interesting. And it also gets to be a little bit too contextual if we are thinking about different species. When we are talking about cells, again, it's kind of simple. It's an exchange of different molecules. And then as communication has evolved, we have this wealth of communication patterns, and we have these co-occurrences of different communication methods that I think it's quite interesting on how do we find that sweet spot between getting lost into so many details and so many contexts versus identifying those universal patterns that can help us better understand the whole process.
One thing I love asking my experts before I send you guys off is, you know, why'd you come on the podcast today? And is there anything that you want to tell our listeners, you know, just to give you some free rein and talk directly to them and you let them know a little bit about yourself and what you're passionate about?
I don't think many people or many scientists have thought of communication in this way before. So I would really like to kind of draw the attention onto looking at something that is so ubiquitous and so obvious that you can actually look at it with a different lens and find something very new and very interesting about it. So that would be one thing. And another thing is that this is a very big topic, and it's not something that, you know, just one scientist or just a small group of scientists that they can work on and solve these problems within a lifetime. I think this is a really important fundamental question that generations of scientists can hopefully work on it, and maybe we'll identify something very, very interesting, not just about ourselves, but again, about how can we find life on other planets, or how can we can we identify life on other planets, whether it's microbial or not, by looking at communication patterns when we don't have the same type of biological reference as we have on other planets as we would have on Earth. So how can we identify life as we don't know it? Then maybe finding these universal patterns of communication will help us get there.
Oh, for sure. And potentially even discovering these universal patterns of communication may help us communicate with life as we don't know it. It may help us, whether it's microbial life and we need to learn how to manipulate it for our own benefit, or maybe it's intelligent life and we need to learn how to coexist and communicate with them effectively.
Yeah,
these methods are extremely important for though solving those problems, especially later down the road.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like I said, it's a really big question, and it's for multiple generations of scientists and teams of scientists to think about.
Well, thank you for taking on the mantle of trying to solve this problem and investigate these things. I'm glad we have scientists like you out there helping us get these results and test these algorithms and these thought processes in new ways. So thank you very much, Anna Maria. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Alien and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.